I realized I had drawn the wrong thing. My classmates' pictures were idyllic and joyous. They were thankful for new puppies or a trip to Disney or skiing at Round Top Mountain. My drawing did not herald any of this. As I looked at their gratitude for magic kingdoms, ski slopes, and puppies, I knew then that I had misunderstood the assignment. I hadn't drawn a vacation or a spectacular gift. I'd drawn something so basic, so simple, and I knew that I stood no chance of winning. After school, I didn't mention the contest or the drawing. I didn't bother my parents with it. Who cared about a second-grade Thanksgiving writing contest? It was 1980, and the Tran family was bustling and bursting with the arrival of my father's parents, his youngest sister, and younger brother in Carlisle. The four of them, my paternal grandparents, Ong Banoy, Go Bai, and Ju Nam, had been left behind in Saigon in 1975. Ong Banoy means paternal grandparents, to be distinguished from Ong Ba Wai, my maternal grandparents. Go Bai and Ju Nam are the titles that my brother and I use to address my father's siblings, our aunts and uncles. Go Bai literally means aunt on my father's side, sixth born. Ju Nam literally means uncle on my father's side, fourth born. Vietnamese has a complex set of pronouns and titles that convey gender, status, paternal or maternal connection, relation by marriage or birth, and birth order among siblings. My grandfather, Ong Noi, planned their escape, and in 1978, he put their plan into motion. They acquired falsified documents, which said that they were Chinese nationals. My uncle, Ju Nam, had secretly installed a tractor engine onto a local river barge, and under cover of night, they stole the barge and chugged away from Saigon, across the Gulf of Thailand. My teenage aunt was disguised as a boy to avoid being raped in the event that they were boarded by pirates. Several days later, they arrived in Malaysia and bribed local officials with 10 gold bullions. And in Malaysia, they languished at a refugee camp for 6 months while they tried to contact my father. They finally arrived in America in January 1979. Photographers met them at the Harrisburg airport. A grainy black and white photo appeared in the local Carlisle paper, along with a story about their harrowing, months-long odyssey. The front page article read, "Boat People Find Refuge in Carlisle." The arrival of more trans was headline news for our drowsy town. My parents rented for Ong Banoy, a vacant apartment across the parking lot in Colonial Square. My aunt Go Bai was enrolled in the high school immediately, for her, a bewildering re-entry into a routine that should have been banal. They had so much to learn about Carlisle, about America, about their new life. My parents didn't have time to pay attention to Lou, me, or Moreland Elementary School's Thanksgiving writing contest, not when they were helping my grandparents adjust to their new life in Carlisle. Even I forgot about the writing contest. 2 weeks later, Mr. Van Zandt came on the loudspeaker to announce the winners of the Thanksgiving contest. I heard clapping from the other classrooms as winners were announced. Oh, right, the contest. The one that I'd gotten wrong because I didn't write about puppies or ski vacations. I looked over at Grace, haloed with her radiant blonde hair and rosy elven features, and assumed that she would win. She had written about a Florida vacation that she and her grandparents had taken, snorkeling, stingrays, sun-bleached sands. And from the second grade, Phuc Tran. I was stunned. Hello, Happy Meal, and an awkward lunch with Mr. Van Zandt. Before I left school that afternoon, I strode down the hall by the library where all the drawings adorned the walls. I scanned the patchwork assemblage of art to look for the yellow winner ribbon pinned to the lower right corner of my drawing. I gazed upon my scribbly masterpiece that had won me a Happy Meal. My drawing was of a rudimentary airplane, and below it were my grandparents, my aunt, and uncle as stick figures, limbs akimbo, dots for eyes. My sentence was scrawled in block letters under the picture. I am thankful that my grandparents are safe in America. To me, it was the most obvious thing that I could have been thankful for. My grandparents, who spoke no English, who had fled Vietnam on a stolen boat, had bested my classmates' new puppies and Disney World vacations and ski weekends. I hadn't misinterpreted the assignment. It was my words that got me a Happy Meal. Words were powerful. They could destroy you, and they could save you, too. And maybe earn you a hot Happy Meal, thankfully. Chapter 4. A Christmas Carol. August, 1981. I'm not going to spank you. We heard him speak those words of mercy, but the tenor of his voice said, "But I want to spank you." In the rear-view mirror, my father's eyes were narrowed, darkened pupils fixed on the road ahead. His voice ground thin and tight, as if in the wrong gear. My mother shifted noiselessly in the front seat. She was always silent under the graze of his forecasted anger. And Lou and I were relieved at his announcement. We hadn't been spanked since Mrs. Boose's visit. Our car sped along a stretch of country road that led from St. Patrick's newer church, erected in fields of whispering corn, folded in undulating meadows of wheat, as if its spire sprouted up as part of the golden harvest. Pennsylvania farmers tilled the earth for corn, wheat, and faith. Lou and I had found church that Sunday morning even more boring than usual, so he and I played Spider Hand. I hummed the Spider-Man theme quietly to him, while my left hand, outstretched like an arachnid, crept glacially toward him, making small minatory movements as we tried to maintain a fragile bubble of Christian composure. The sacrosanct surroundings of St. Patrick's demanded that we comport ourselves with the respect that was eternally due to our Lord and Savior. Jesus' effigy floated triumphantly above the altar and its proceedings, his statue's complexion painted the same beige color as JCPenney's mannequins. But instead of offering summer khakis and blazers, Jesus was presenting eternal salvation with his palms outstretched, revealing his wounds to us. In the pew, my father glared at Lou and me, sensing that nincompoopery was afoot. My mother's attention, as always, tuned in faithfully to Father Fontanella's homily, even if her listening comprehension was unreliable. Her chin raised up as if she were at a microphone too tall, the up-tilt of her face allowing her to watch Father Fontanella and mannequin Jesus at the same time. My left hand crept slowly toward Lou, who was awash in chortles, as Spider Hand inched closer and closer. I softly sang to him, Spider Hand, friendly neighborhood Spider Hand. My mother heard Lou laughing and elbowed me. Lou snorted, covering his mouth with both hands, his face frozen with a look of both terror and hilarity. He and I sprung leaks of snickering, which in church sounded loud and inappropriate. My father hissed at us to be quiet, and the white family in front of us did the looking but not looking over the shoulder glower of reproach. My mother's face turned scarlet with embarrassment, and my father grabbed Lou by the arm, sliding him over to the other side of the pew. Game over. After Mass, we piled into our red Ford LTD, which had replaced the green Pontiac. Lou and I anticipating some repercussions of our misbehavior in Mass. My father's brow was creased, asymmetrically folded and ruddy like angry origami. His chin, flecked with the weekend's stubble, bent an unmoving frown. Trouble was up ahead. Lou and I were relieved when, in the car ride home, my father announced, "I'm not going to spank you." The cornfields whooshed by in the open window and then slowed. He pulled the car onto the shoulder. "Get out." He didn't turn around, and Lou and I weren't sure what he meant and whom he meant. "What?" I looked at the rearview mirror to see that he was bank-shotting a look at me. "What do you mean, get out?" "Get out," I said. "Fup, get out of the car." "What are you doing? He can't get out." My mother's voice was shrill and frantic while Lou and I remained frozen. No one was getting out of the car. My father raised his voice to a full yell. "Get out of the car! Get out right now! Out of the car!" I got out. The smell of August's fresh manure stung my nose and eyes. I scanned the berm for a comfortable place to lie down. If he was going to beat me by the side of the road, at least we were out of public view, clear of humiliation. Was I going to lie in the grass, on some fallen corn stalks? I knew that he didn't travel with the metal rod, and the more I anticipated being spanked, the more I was oddly confident. I was confident that I could physically endure whatever he had to mete out, since he didn't have the metal rod. My butt was ready for whatever, except for what happened next. He closed the door behind me and peeled away in a crackle of gravel and acceleration. My butt was not expecting that. I heard my mother through its open window, "What are you doing?" Between the road and the cornfield, the dust drifted behind the car, settling down as my surprise rose up. What had just happened? Was this their version of leaving me in a basket of reeds by the Nile? I listened to the shushing of the tires until I heard nothing but the faraway gargling of a tractor and the rural fugue of crickets, birds, and distant dogs. The late summer corn was taller than I was, and on both sides of the road arose rustling walls of green. This was a joke, right? They couldn't possibly have just left me on the side of the road, did they? I had a vague notion of which direction to walk and was surprisingly sure that someone would help me. I knew my address and my phone number. I didn't believe that I was abandoned by the side of the road, and my 7-year-old brain calculated that getting kicked out of the car was better than getting beaten. No fear for what was going to happen next. No fear of the future. Totally calm, I squatted in a small grassy strip, picking up a few flat rocks to toss. I pushed the roadside gravel into a small ziggurat and put a stalk of weed at the top to crown my achievement. For 7-year-old Fook, the math on this one was easier to explain. Abandoned is greater than beaten equals calm. This was another theory of relativity, not brilliant, but just as practical. I had experienced so much dread by that point in my life that being forced out of the car on a beautiful August day was, well, it wasn't the worst thing that could happen to me. When a kid gets the tar beaten out of him for the first 7 years of his life, what more will be an effective deterrent? My past wasn't a Dickensian horror show of Victorian orphanages and hard labor, but it did make my present predicament relatively benign. I decided that I would walk home in a few hours, or at least head in the general direction of what I thought was home. But for the moment, I figured that it was better to stay put in case my parents changed their minds about Mosesing me and came back around. I hummed the Blondie song, "The Tide is High," that my Uncle Ty played constantly on his 45 RPM single, as I picked up more rocks to toss by the side of the road. After some time had passed, my stomach growled, and I grew restless. I stood up and found a stick to swat at the corn stalks for fun. In the most dire circumstance, I figured that I could walk to a nearby farmhouse for food. Pacing back and forth, I whacked the corn stalks with my stick as hard as I could. Thwack, thwack. Maybe a half hour had passed? Maybe an hour? The August midday sun throbbed, and the manure in the air had a cloying smell as the breeze pushed it around. The odor hovered at the edges, but it wasn't going anywhere. Two cars had passed by me since I had been roadside, neither of them stopping or even slowing. I had been so intent on busying myself with my stick and rocks that no alarm was indicated. Just a 7-year-old Vietnamese kid in the Pennsylvania countryside, whacking corn stalks with a stick. No big deal. I heard another car drive up and slow down, eventually stopping next to me. It was our Ford. Without turning around, my father growled from the front seat, "Get in." I opened the door and slid across the vinyl. If I had guessed, I would have surmised that my mother had begged my father to come back and get me, but I didn't ask. I didn't want to risk being misinterpreted and getting kicked out of the car again, silent as we drove home. I was hot and thirsty and happy that I didn't have to walk home. Did we have a meaningful discussion about why my father kicked me out of the car? We didn't. My father's one parenting tool, physical violence, seemed no longer to be an option, but his rage and spring-loaded temper remained flexed, ready to snap at any trigger. Without a physical recourse in his parenting, since he now feared the shame of having my teacher come to our home again, he resorted to yelling and the tyranny of fear. Fear would keep me and Lou in line, but what did Lou and I fear now that we didn't fear his beatings? Did he think that we feared our abusive, ill-tempered father would abandon us? Did we fear that someone else would have to care for us? That didn't seem like a terrible proposition to me. I know that I was not the first kid in the history of the world to wish that someone else were his father, to wish that his parents were anyone else. I would have settled for one of my aunts or uncles for my parents. They were nice. They could take care of us. My uncle, Chutu, took me and Lou swimming at Dickinson College all the time. He was a chef for the college's dining hall. Who else could be our parents? Maybe some white people. Maybe one of our sponsors would adopt me and Lou. That seemed fine to me. Their houses were grand multi-room castles. They always smiled and said things like, "Come on in," or "Make yourselves at home," or "Can I get you something to drink?" And even if they did beat their kids, maybe that was a price worth paying in order to have a home like they did. For what was I paying my price? From the back seat of the Ford, looking out at the grand expanses of farm and country, I murmured a pagan prayer, not directing it to Jesus, God, or anyone in particular. It was to the universe, to everybody and nobody, a message in a bottle. The worst outcome would be that nothing would change. Was it a sin to pray for different parents? A dad who didn't beat you? A mom who protected you? Parents who understood the world that you lived in? I didn't pray for my father to be different or kinder or more loving because I couldn't imagine him that way. He never spoke to us with affection or tenderness. His anger and his violence shaped how I saw him, and I wasn't sure he would even be my father without the anger and violence. But I didn't want him as he was. As is was the terms of sale for parents and children. The wish for different parents fuels the archetypal fairy tales about evil stepmothers and children left in the woods. These fairy tales pivot around the wish that our parents, irascible and imperfect, aren't even our real parents, that a fairy godmother will reveal to us our true royal bloodline or magical lineage. Whether you're Harry Potter or Luke Skywalker or Cinderella, the fantasy is that the adults who are raising you aren't even your real parents, that your real parents are kinder and magical. The fantasy is that you have a destiny that is greater and more splendid than your current fate's contours. On that car ride home, I dismissed that unbridled fantasy with stiff, sobering logic. If this was the worst that could transpire, I would be okay. I would be okay because I had known worse. My father hadn't beaten me or Lou in months. That was already an improvement, and I could live through the punishment of getting kicked out of the car. My past was worse than my present, and if my present indicated my future, I could live with that. December 1981. My mother's footsteps clomped down the stairs. "Turn off the scary movie! You guys are scaring the other kids!" My mother Vietnamesed at me. "Look at your cousin T. She's crying. She came upstairs crying." "What are you talking about? We're watching a Christmas movie on CBS. This is a Christmas movie. It's about Jesus." "Maybe." I implored her to keep the TV on. I had invoked the name of Jesus, not as expletive, but as co-star. I didn't know if Jesus was in it. I had heard on a commercial break that the movie was called A Christmas Carol, and I knew that Christmas was sometimes about Jesus. If anything stopped my mother in her tracks, it was Jesus and the invocation of Jesus. My mother's two eldest brothers and two eldest sisters had married and added their own kids, so there multiplied a quorum of young cousins in the basement, among whom I was the alpha cousin. This meant that nearly a dozen kids were all shoved downstairs with a couch and TV, while the adults gathered upstairs to prepare dinner. Cooking was an all-day affair for the grown-ups, which meant that, without real adult intervention, it was Lord of the Flies in the basement. TV was the common denominator and pacifier. TV offered a respite from noogies, wedgies, arm burns, and all other punishments that trickled down in the brutal basement economy. "This is not a Christmas movie," my mother pushed back. "Why is that old man screaming?" "He's being haunted by ghosts." "Why are there ghosts in a Christmas movie?" "I don't know, but it is a Christmas movie." "It is. Look." My mother assumed that I was lying until I presented Exhibit A. the Evening Sentinel's TV guide in black and white. Look, A Christmas Carol. See? I told you it was a Christmas movie. This was no comfort to my cousin T, who was still sniffling. On the small TV screen, the ghost of Christmas Present had just revealed two emaciated orphans beneath his cloak, and we were all transfixed. I was excited to see that it was sort of a horror movie and sort of a Christmas movie, a strange holiday film to be sure. There was no Santa, Claymation, Rudolph, or jazzy Charlie Brown. Just ghosts and regrets and British people. My mother looked resigned. Well, it's too loud. Turn it down. I noted that she said turn down, not turn off. Christmas won. Triumphant, I lowered the volume on the TV, but my mother's question began to haunt me. Why were there ghosts in a Christmas movie? When I first read A Christmas Carol, I wasn't scared of the ghosts. I was, however, captivated by the idea of being haunted by the past. And beyond the chokehold of regret, I loved Dickens's reflections on the past, on the present, and on the cautionary lessons for the future. It's one of the earliest time-bending stories, shuffling the time deck backward and forward. Ebenezer Scrooge is trying to save his future, but unlike the Terminator and Marty McFly, Scrooge seeks his salvation not by altering the past, which for Dickens is unalterable, but by changing the present. Changing the present so that he can save the future. The future is what's at stake. Marley's ghost tells Scrooge that he will be visited by three ghosts. Scrooge visits himself as a child, and in the next moment he sees himself as a young man. Dickensian time is jumbled, relative, and malleable. At the end of A Christmas Carol, Scrooge awakens in the present day, realizing that he can still save himself, that he can indeed save the future. Scrooge is overjoyed and cries out twice, "I will live in the past, present, and the future." For a long time, this passage in Dickens didn't make much sense to me, until I started to think about my parents, my grandparents, and me. We were the past, present, and future. Each of us an element of that continuum, yet constantly shifting, depending on the other's perspective. Christmas Eve, 1981. Lou and I bounded into Ombawai's apartment ahead of our parents, where everyone had gathered. We made the rounds like good little Confucian Catholics, bowing to our elders as instructed by my parents, saying, "Jiao," the formal Vietnamese greeting. We bowed, moving from one elder to the next. Hugs and kisses showered us from our aunts and grandmother, while our uncles and grandfather nodded at our greetings, waving us off. Jiao amwai, bow. Jiao bawai, bow. My great-grandmother, Bako, 85 years old, was seated at the head of the large table, holding court in the dining room. Jiao Bako, bow. Bako, can you do ba fu tui? Do ba fu tui, please. Lou and I begged her to do the game of old witch lady. In the initial tide of trans in 1975, my great-grandmother, Bako, at 79, made the journey to America with us. With iron resolve, she'd endured a lifetime of wars, the escape from Saigon, and various relocations from refugee camp to refugee camp. A force of nature, the spirit of our family incarnate, she was an unbreakable woman, a relic of the old country, a piece of the past. While all the other women in our family wore Western-style clothing, Bako always wore an áo dài, the traditional Vietnamese long dress that women wore. Because her hair grew far past her lower back, she braided and wrapped it in a piece of black velvet, which was like a giant sock or a woman's stocking, and then wrapped the braid around her head in a large black turban. As the eldest in our family, she was distinguished by and revered for her age, set apart by her status, and her distinctive turban. Bako hugged us as Lou and I begged her to play Ba Phu Toi. Her tiny, thin hands, bones wrapped in skin, reached up behind her head and released her turban, which uncoiled to her left in a slow, serpentine stretch. The soft, dark velvet of the turban wrap loosened to reveal silvery hair and a waist-length braid that Bako unraveled with a high, shrill cackle. Lou and I were giddy as her braid came apart into a gray sheet of hair. She pulled all of her hair forward so that it shrouded her face completely. Her hair was so long that it pooled around her knees and hips as she sat motionless behind the white pall. We laughed and pushed each other at the macabre sight as Bako reached under the folds of her hair. After a moment of stillness, we heard her remove her dentures with a wet sucking sound, and a row of human teeth emerged from the hair. Lou and I were beside ourselves. She placed the dentures on the dining room table next to her, and with her face still hidden behind the curtain of her hair, she began to moan lowly.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh."
Her hair moved in and out, and she moaned louder. Lou and I were chattering in laughter and terror. She lurched out of her chair, both hands clawing out for us blindly in front of her.
"Ooh."
Lou and I both screamed and fell to the floor, but we didn't scurry away. She parted her hair just at her chin, revealing only her wrinkled mouth, shapeless and glistening from the absence of dentures. Her moans now became audible words.
"Bafutui, bafutui. I'm the witch, I'm the witch."
We were writhing on the floor in mock terror as she huddled over us, her hair shrouding us. We smelled her tiger balm ointment, which she always wore as both a perfume and arthritic analgesic. Her toothless maw, warm and wet, slobbered on our cheeks and the nape of our necks as she pretended to eat, but was really kissing us. More screaming and shrieking.
"Bafutui, bafutui."
My mother interceded. "Okay, that's enough. You two go to the basement and leave Bako alone. Go watch TV." Bako caught her breath and straightened up, brushing her hair back and plopping her teeth back in as she smiled. One last hug and wet kiss before we headed to the basement. Lou and I heard our cousin's laughter at the basement door, the clacking of a ping pong game, the TV in the background, as we clambered down the steps. December 30th, 1981. Lou and I scanned the Evening Sentinel's TV guide section. Late night movie. "What movie are they showing?" "It just says late night movie," I explained to Lou. "Is it a good one? What movie is it?" "Good grief, I don't know. Late night movie. That's all it says. We're just gonna have to see." "Dad, can we sleep on the couch tonight?" My parents talked to each other for a minute. It was a Wednesday night, but during the week between Christmas and New Year's Eve, every night was an excuse to pull out the couch and stay up late. On special occasions, my parents let me and my brother sleep on our pull-out couch. The break from routine, the exceptionalism of sleeping on the pull-out, was a huge joy for us, even though our bedroom lay 8 feet away. "Okay, sure. You two can sleep out on the couch." My brother and I hopped up and down as if a piñata had burst overhead and hugged our parents. They might as well have declared a second Christmas. Cushions off, couch out, blankets, pillows, and a few stuffed animals trailing us from the bedroom. Carlisle's local ABC affiliate broadcasted old movies after the 11 o'clock news, a random assortment of black and white films in 70s cinema, The African Queen, The Maltese Falcon, Shane, The Dirty Dozen. The highlight for us was when they had aired King Kong a few months back. That night, King Kong night, we stayed up until the national anthem played, an American flag glowing in the dark for a few minutes before the static signaled the end of TV, the thing that seemed to have no end. We theorized about what the movie might be, but in truth, we didn't care. We were nestled into the somnolent fortress of pillows and blankets, basking in the TV's blue light. Programming was irrelevant. A made-for-TV drama came on after The Fall Guy, and our boredom led to inactivity, and our inactivity led to drowsiness. Lights on, TV blaring. Our parents covered us, turned off the TV, and retired to their bedroom because Lou and I had fallen asleep long before the start of the late-night movie. At some point in the night, I jolted awake. I thought I heard something. Sirens, fire trucks. I saw the tail end of red and white lights fluttering on the curtains of the living room. In the dark, I rubbed my eyes and glanced around at the scratchy silhouettes of the television, the lamps, the coffee table. I looked down the hallway toward the bedrooms, and I saw my great-grandmother standing in the hall. She stood right in front of the bathroom door, silent and unmoving, but I knew her immediately by her form, her tiny stature topped by the bulbous turban. "Ciao, bucko. Ciao." I greeted her and put my head down on my pillow, settling back to sleep. I lay next to my brother, listening to the fading sirens. I thought for a moment about my great-grandmother being in our apartment. Why was she there? Did my parents go get her? When did they do that? Since Lou and I were in the living room, maybe she was having a sleepover in one of our beds. I'd find out in the morning. Too tired to continue, I drifted back to sleep. Suddenly, I was awake again. The lights were on. Was it morning? My mother nudged me and Lou. "Fulp and Lou, get up." She stood by with our coats in hand. "Put on your coats. We have to go." My father came out from the kitchen. There was a fire at the other apartment building where Omba White lived. A big fire. Our coats went on wordlessly as we ventured outside. The cold December set our teeth, rattling. From the back seat of the Ford, Lou and I were knuckling the sleep from our eyes, trying to piece together what my parents were saying to each other. A fusillade of questions from us. What happened? Who started the fire? Was anyone hurt? How big was the fire? Were there fire trucks? Is it still on fire? They ignored us. I could see my father's brow clenched deeper than usual as we drove uninterrupted through the blinking traffic signals, as my mom cried in the passenger seat. Lou and I stopped talking as we felt the cold glaze of fear and dread frost over in the car. Past a short six blocks, we pulled up to Umbawai's apartment complex. The flashing of the fire engine lights illuminated the parking lot and onlookers. Dozens of neighbors stood around in the late December air with hastily pulled on layers, bathrobes, coats, slippers, boots. Their warm exhalations puffed red and white as emergency lights pulsed. My grandmother, grandfather, my uncles and aunts crowded together on the sidewalk, fire department blankets cloaked over their shoulders, disheveled and disbelieving. My parents parked near the fire engines and told me and Lou to stay in the car. We pivoted to our knees to look out the rear window as they headed over to the crowd, their profiles glowing with lights. Even from inside the car, the December air was smeared with smoke and the sickly sweet of burnt plastic. It looked like everyone was okay. In spite of the army of fire trucks amassed, the building wasn't the ash heap I was expecting. From where we were parked, it looked normal except for one blackened, broken window up to which a fire ladder extended. Around the window, a halo of soot and melted beige vinyl siding marred the otherwise mundane building face, a gouged and charred eye socket. My parents stayed for a while, helping to arrange for everyone to stay at my Uncle Joe's apartment, which was in the same complex, and we headed home, exhausted. Back inside at Walnut Bottom Road, still zipped up in our winter coats, our parents sat us in their laps and told us that Paco was hurt badly in the fire. She had been taken away to the hospital and we would know more in the morning. As they told me this, I looked down the hall of our apartment, where I had just seen her. I hadn't seen her in the group of survivors, but I assumed that she was sleeping over at our apartment. I saw her in our hallway that night. I saw her. And now my parents were telling me that she had been trapped in the fire. Lou asked more questions that my parents couldn't answer while I sat, glancing occasionally down the hallway. I started to doubt what I saw. Maybe I didn't see Bako in the hallway. But I did. But she hadn't been here. She was in the other apartment building. We later learned from the fire department that the fire had started in her room and no one was able to get past the flames to reach her. Unresponsive and badly burned, she had been taken in an ambulance to the ICU. Bako? She had survived all the wars, all the helicopters, boats, and planes, all the relocation camps in Guam, Wake Island, Fort Indiantown Gap. Had lived to see snow for her first time as an octogenarian, only to be engulfed in flames in her apartment. That weekend, the apartment management moved Ombawai, my aunt, and two uncles across the parking lot to another three-bedroom unit. and we helped them drag the smoky remnants of their possessions in plastic shopping bags into the new apartment. My grandparents visited my great-grandmother in the ICU and reported what little news they could parse from the doctors, but we younger children didn't go to the hospital. We were planted in front of the television as the grown-ups began stoically piecing together their lives again. My parents helped Ombawai and everyone collect and sort more clothing and furnishings from our sponsors. If they suffered or were devastated by the fire, they didn't show us, shouldering the tragedy with a tacit steeliness. Bako never regained consciousness, and she died a few days later from her burns and smoke inhalation. She was 85. My grandmother, Bawai, as the new matriarch of the family, insisted on an open casket at Bago's funeral, her first unilateral decision, a decision that was roundly protested but dutifully obeyed. No one wanted an open casket for a burn victim, but my grandmother insisted. At the funeral, my first, Lou and I recoiled at the charred remains of Bago, the smooth polish of the casket, a sharp counterpoint to her blackened features, only vaguely human and distinctly not her. Great care had been taken to wrap the turban around her head, even though all her hair had burned off. A pastiche of the past. My father pushed me and Lou toward the casket as we protested, but he insisted that we pay our respects. Confucian filial piety, laminated with Third World Catholicism, overrode any sensible restraint. He gripped our arms as he marched us down to the prie-dieu to kneel. I lowered myself in front of the casket, remembering the false terror that Lou and I had felt in our game with Bako, feeling the awful, real terror of beholding her disfigured face and hands. Lou and I held hands and cried together, shedding tears that she might wake up and be in pain from the burns, tears for her death, tears for the horror of beholding what used to be her. Nearly every book and film that has ever had a ghost in the plot will tell you, a ghost doesn't randomly show up without being a crucial narrative element. When ghosts show up in literature or film, they expedite or pivot the story. In Hamlet, a murdered father appears to demand his revenge. In Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi slips into the snowy vapors of Hoth to tell Luke where to finish his Jedi training. In the Odyssey, our hero Odysseus goes to Hades, the grand central terminal of ghosts, to get some advice and direction that, apparently, he couldn't get from the living. And of course, Dickens's A Christmas Carol has the nightmare of spooky visions of what would have been, what is, and what could be. The ghosts create meaning and impetus. In the aftermath of seeing Bako's ghost, I didn't know what it meant. Bako didn't say anything. She just stood there. I saw her in the hallway, and I went back to sleep. And then she was burned in the fire. Was she a premonition of an unavoidable tragedy? If so, why did I see her? Was she a vision of the past, present, or future? Or was she just a ghost, an apparition, a phenomenon with no larger or deeper significance than what I wanted to make of it? Maybe she wanted to see me one last time. Maybe she wanted me to see her one last time. I believe that I did. April 1982. Do you want to go to the movies next weekend? I was shocked. My father had asked me if I wanted to go to the movies. The movies. Going to the movies had been a chore outsourced to my uncles and cousins. My cousins on Staten Island had taken me to witness Rocky Balboa defeat Apollo Creed in Rocky II. My uncles dragged me to see Cheech and Chong's weed-fueled adventures, which I distinctly remember not understanding nor enjoying. Some older cousins took me along to see The Blues Brothers, which I also didn't understand. Sometimes I was brought along at the insistence of Bawai. Oh, you're going to the movies? Why don't you take Fop too? Their eyeballs rolled their annoyance that their young tag-along was coming too. Of course, no one gave a moment's thought to the movie's rating, and my frequent suggestions that we see an animated or kids' film were quashed unilaterally. I wanted to see Tron, but we saw Friday the 13th instead. I wanted to see The Last Unicorn, but we saw Conan the Barbarian instead. And during the movies, I triggered a landslide of shushing from my cousins. Who's that? What's this? why he's smoking that. Why is he killing that guy? Who's that guy anyway? Shush, shush. Jesus, you're so annoying. Shush. My father, however, rarely took me to the movies. I immediately assented to his suggestion to see a movie and threw my arms around him. A movie? Sure. What movie? I read about the movie in the newspaper. It's the best movie in America. I think we should go see it. He was referring to the winner of the Oscar for Best Picture that year. Not that it made a difference to me. Reading the Evening Sentinel was my father's daily ongoing effort at gaining some cultural competency and improving his reading comprehension. The best movie in America? That sounds good. What's it called? Chariots of Fire. Whoa, that does sound good. I had never heard of it, but with the logic of a third grader, I parsed the title Chariots of Fire literally and aggrandized my father's enthusiasm at seeing the best movie in America. I had seen Clash of the Titans at my grandparents' house. The trans were moving up in the world. My grandparents had premium cable television and a VCR. And with that, Amwat had begun a small collection of movies that he pirated from HBO and Prism. Clash of the Titans, with its sword fights, skeleton armies, and a kraken, reigned as a household favorite. How much more awesome could Chariots of Fire be than Clash of the Titans? Can I bring a friend to the movie? It was rare that my parents allowed us to invite friends to the apartment or on outings with our family. The idea of a sleepover was a foreign concept, and they didn't understand why we would want to invite other kids to our house to play, as opposed to meeting outside and playing there. My father's past history, built upon so many no's, tottered with an uncharacteristic yes. Yes, you can bring one friend. We can get popcorn, too. Maybe that will be fun. He said yes, and he said fun. I hardly recognized my father, the stern, domineering killjoy who reigned with an iron bar. I didn't want to push my luck with more questions. The date was set. Chariots of Fire. Next Saturday, there would be popcorn. I could bring a friend. It would be fun. This was not the father that I knew, not the Chan Tran of the past, not the one whose replacement I had prayed for. At recess that Monday, I ascended the monkey bars and surveyed my choices of whom to invite. This was Chariots of Fire, after all. From my perch, I considered my options. Craig Fleckman, my longtime friend since kindergarten, was in the other third grade class. It was the first time that we were not in the same class together, which meant that we might as well have been on different planets. Our love of Star Wars was strong, but not that strong. We were on hiatus. Lizzie Kenyon? She was sort of a friend, but to invite a girl? Nope. I didn't want anyone to think that I was asking a girl to be my girlfriend, and especially not Lizzie Kenyon. No girls. That eliminated over half the class. I could invite the kids with whom I wanted to be friends, but that seemed like an overreach. With only one berth for movie going, I couldn't risk the humiliation of asking a series of kids, only to have them refuse. Eli Huey it was. Winner. He was my go-to friend at recess, and I his. Eli was new to our school that year, and he and I were seated near each other. He was a fast runner, laughed at my jokes, ate his boogers, liked Star Wars. He lived in a nearby apartment complex and was the only other kid I knew in my class who also lived in an apartment. The parallels of our housing situations allowed me to map my experience onto Eli, which I couldn't do with other kids. Maybe people banged on his apartment floor too, as they did at our apartment. Maybe he shared a room with his sibling. Maybe his mom said no to toys because they didn't have enough money. I asked Eli if he wanted to go to the movies with me and my dad, and he, like me, was hooked by the title. Chariots of Fire? Yeah, definitely. I gotta ask my mom, but yeah, I definitely want to go. His mom said yes that night, and for the rest of the week during recess, Eli and I agreed to play Chariots of Fire in anticipation of the movie. Our imaginations ran unbridled. What do the chariots look like? Do you think they're always on fire? Do you think they shoot fire too? What sorts of creatures do you think pull them? Horses? Maybe Pegasuses? In our frenzy, we hoped that the movie was a sequel to Clash of the Titans, or at least borrowed from Greek mythology. By Friday's last recess, Eli and I had unspooled a tangled plot about the heroes, villains, and monsters, all of whom rode chariots. Chariots of fire. Saturday afternoon, we drove to the theater, Eli and I excitedly discussing the movie on the drive over. How could the movie not live up to the title? It was the best movie in America, and it had chariots of fire in it, and my father had suggested that we go. His involvement was thrilling for me. My father had not taken me to Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back, but here we were together, seated on red upholstered movie theater seats, popcorn in our laps, my father on my left and Eli on my right. The theater darkened and trailers for upcoming releases of boring, talky movies flickered on the screen. And then the movie began. A church flickered onto the screen. Some sort of mass. Okay, this was weird. And then a bunch of men in white underwear were running on the beach. I thought maybe we were watching a trailer for another movie, but the title card came up. Chariots of Fire. Had we made a mistake? Maybe the chariots would come later? Patience. It had only been 3 minutes. I looked at Eli, who was munching away at his popcorn. He caught my eye and shrugged, happy to be eating an entire bag of popcorn by himself. An eternity passed. Still more running on the beach and through town. There were long close-ups of faces and even more running. The time period was not a mythical era with Medusas or Krakens. It was 20th century England. There were no swords, sandals, or togas. It was just supercilious Englishmen talking and running against the synthetic swelling ch-ch-ch-ch-ch of Vangelis' theme song. At least that sounded cool. The movie ran on longer without any signs of a chariot or fire. My confusion was supplanted by embarrassment 30 minutes into the movie. This was not the chariots of fire that we had made up in our heads. This was not what I had promised to Eli, and I couldn't bear to gaze upon the disappointment that he shared with me, the disbelief that this movie was actually about Englishmen talking and running. I didn't want to look at Eli, even there in the dark, but I did. I forced myself. Eli was asleep. Asleep amid unpopped kernels and the collapsed rubble of his popcorn bag. He snored slightly. I had invited one friend to a movie, and that movie was so boring, so terrible, that he fell asleep. My father nudged me. "Wake up. It's time to go. The movie's over." I didn't remember falling asleep. The credits were rolling, and my lips stung from the salt that had crusted the corners of my mouth for the last 90 minutes. My father seemed chipper. "That was a pretty good movie, huh? Very inspiring. Geez, it was very inspiring. Did you sleep through the whole thing?" "Sorry, I didn't know what else to say." Eli piped up. "I get so sleepy when I eat, and then in the theater it gets dark." He shrugged and picked his nose. We were silent on the car ride home from the theater, fully awake and refreshed from our nap, but bereft of the customary post-movie post-mortem of "wasn't it cool when" and "what about the part when?" We dropped Eli off at his apartment and headed home. Lou wanted to know right away about the movie. "How was Chariots of Fire?" "It was okay, I guess." "What? Just okay? What do you mean?" "I mean, I fell asleep." "And Eli fell asleep." "But it was Chariots of Fire." "I know. But it's not what you think. I can't tell you what it was about, but it's not what you think it sounds like." We kids lived in a world that was barely metaphorical, where titles for movies and TV shows were tantamount to the ingredient labels. Fantasy Island was a fantasy island. The Love Boat was a love boat. The Dukes of Hazzard were the Dukes of Hazzard. But Chariots of Fire? No chariots. No fire. "It was very inspiring. Good story." My father put his arm around my shoulders, but having fallen asleep, I couldn't disagree. It was an optimistic appraisal. I was still deflated and cranky from the movie not living up to my expectations, and I squirmed in his embrace. I placed all the blame squarely upon my father. He had said that it was a great movie, but it was actually terrible. He had failed me again. I heaped chariots of fire on top of Wookiee and Colonel and countless other misunderstandings and errors. Another instance of his inability to navigate the world with competency. My embarrassment from the chariots of fire fiasco was acute, but in retrospect, I'm able to see more clearly that he tried. It was, after all, the best movie of 1982. It had a cool title and we had popcorn. I can't remember many moments in my childhood where my father made a good faith effort to do something fun, but I remember this one. As an adult, I've been able to understand that my father was not as trapped by his past as I thought he was. He was often violent and angry. But now I can look back and see that he tried to do fun things from time to time. Things that didn't fit into the narrow, cartoonish image that I formed of him. Fossil hunting on the shores of Pincho Lake. Visits to the Indian Echo Caverns in Hummelstown. Impromptu trips to Washington, D.C. to see the Smithsonian because it was free. I had witnessed the tension of who he was and who he was trying to be. I wanted him to be loving and kind, but his old behavior, his temper, his rage, eclipsed his attempts at being a better father. The past pulled us, and the future pushed us, the tension of tenses. We lived in the past, the present, and the future. It wasn't only laid out in my grandparents, my parents, and me. It was in our relationships. It was in how we treated one another and how we looked at one another, heedless of who we actually were. My adult uncles were still slapped as if they were children. We could never grow up in our parents' eyes, but they could not grow or change in ours either. Our past behaviors, our present needs, our future goals, all of them snares. But even if the past is unchangeable, maybe our perspective of the past can change. And maybe the way we see past events can change. And if that can change, maybe the past event itself does change, not in action or outcome, but in purpose and intent. I couldn't see it in the moment, but through the years, with the interplay of memories, experience, and perspective, I've come to see our trip to the movies not as another failure by my father, but rather as an attempt to connect to his son. But in that present moment, I couldn't see it for what it was. I was unable to see past our past.
Chapter 5. Man and His Symbols. August, 1983. Where are you people from? We were shopping at Giant, pushing our cart slowly. Lou and I took turns dangling from the cart, making impassioned pleas to our parents to buy Count Chocula. An older gentleman stepped into our path, intercepting us with his question, the question that, as I grew up in Carlisle, I would sustain regularly, a query angled with varying degrees of inflection, from curious to neutral to cutting. Where are you people from? Even at 9 years old, I heard the nuances of you people. I caught his drift. His drift was sharp and edgy. It was pointed. His drift didn't sound like a friendly game of catch. My parents hadn't heard him because they were Vietnamesing with each other about their shopping list, and they weren't expecting anyone to speak to them. No one knew us in that informal, neighborly way, and my parents weren't part of the small-town colloquium that burbled and babbled around us. I saw other people, friends and neighbors, stopping and talking to one another. How's Little League? Donna doing okay? Did you see the game last night? We weren't in Little League. No one asked about my mother's health. We didn't watch sports on TV. The man spoke up louder with the kind of volume that inferred lack of Englishing. Where are you people from? I nudged my father, who broke off from his conversation with my mother, to acknowledge the man. Yes, sir? Always publicly polite. Where are you people from? The man had yellow-tinted aviators and a graying mustache, reminding me of Magnum P.I. from TV. His belly overhung a large buckle, pressing taut against his plaid shirt. Maybe he was a private eye. Maybe he was working a case or was grocery store security. Oh, we are from Vietnam. My father smiled widely, nervously. His default was always to smile in awkward or strange situations, but I felt his posture tense up. My father also caught the man's drift, and he moved protectively in between the man and us.
Yeah, thought so. Thought I recognized it. Vietnamese. I haven't heard it since I was in country. Thought to myself, sounds like Vietnamese.
Lou started to correct the man's pronunciation of Vietnamese, but I kicked him from behind the cart. Lou caught my drift as well, and he shut up.
In the Marines there, stationed in Da Nang, 68 to 69.
He looked at all of us as he spoke, eyes slinking from my father's rigid smile to my mother, to us kids.
Oh yes, Da Nang is in the middle of Vietnam. We're from Saigon.
My father continued to smile as we stood still, nervous prey, whiffing a predatory scent. My eyes scanned the American flag pin and other buttons on his jacket lapel. The gentleman looked at us, but his eyes were distant, their focus going far beyond where we were, right through us. I looked behind myself at the produce section, understanding that he wasn't looking at the broccoli or cabbage.
Beautiful country there, Nam.
He said Nam with a southern lilt.
Nam.
Carlisle, surprising to most outsiders, has a slight southern drawl to its local dialect.
Beautiful country, Nam. Goddamn shame what happened there.
My father nodded.
Goddamn shame, the man murmured.
We all nodded and stood there for a time, staring at Mr. Magnum P.I. as he stared at the broccoli behind us. We as a family, in turn, looked blankly around. My parents gazed farther down the aisle, Lou and I fidgeting wordlessly at the cart, everyone bobbling their heads. The man hadn't asked us a question, so we had no answer to give.
Well, you people have a good day.
Thank you. You too, sir.
My father and mother smiled and waved. Lou had used the distraction to sneak a box of Count Chocula into the cart. He nudged me.
Why did that man ask us where we were from?
My parents had already wandered farther down the aisle, sorting through the different cooking oils on the shelves. I was pushing the cart, so I answered Lou.
Because that man fought in the Vietnam War.
The metal grocery cart resumed its screechy circuit in between the aisles.
So?
Well, we're from Vietnam.
I said Vietnam the way the man had said it.
Not me. I was born here in Carlisle.
Lou had a point.
Well, that is true, but people are always going to ask you where you're from.
But I'm from Pennsylvania. Spoken like the future lawyer he would be.
It's true, you were born here, but it won't make sense to people. They'll still ask you where you're from. They mean mom and dad, and me, your family, where we're from.
How did that man know that we weren't from here?
It's complicated.
I chose not to explain bigotry to Lou, though he probably already knew it. He had experience being the only one in his classes too, but at least the other one at school was his brother. I was blindly hoping that he wasn't aware of the prejudice, but who was I kidding? Whose innocence was I trying to preserve?
Why did he say that it was a shame what happened?
Lou persisted.
I don't know. He didn't really say, did he?
I was pained to tell Lou to get used to being asked where he was from, but he had to, and eventually he would, whether I warned him or not, get used to it or get crushed by it. We all learned quickly to smile and nod whenever veterans would see us and tell us that they were in Nam. They named their branch of service, told us what years they were there, where they were stationed, and how they found the people or the weather. Later, when I was older and a little savvier, I would round out my exchange by saying something like, "Thanks for your service," or, "My grandparents worked for the U.S. Embassy," volunteering something to identify myself as one of the good ones. But that was much later, when I realized that this wasn't about me or my family. It was about them and what we symbolized for them. How could I explain to Lou that we were symbols, that some people would never be able to see us as just people, that we were symbols of a painful and confusing war? Symbols of the refugees they saw on TV. Symbols of what they were afraid of. Symbols of the people who had shot at them and killed their friends, brothers, and sons. Symbols of whatever they wanted to see. That was what we were for Mr. Magnum P.I. In the middle of the giant grocery store, we had to pause our shopping and be symbols for what he saw in the fuzzy, distant gaze of recollection and trauma. The trans didn't choose to be symbolic or archetypal, but it wasn't our choice to make. Our family was a symbol long before any of us could identify that feeling of being a symbol. Symbols of the war, icons of America's foreign policy, representatives of a country that people had only seen on silver screens and the convex glass of TV sets. I felt my symbolism long before I knew it. When I was young and people hated me, called me a gook or a chink, asked me where I was from, I thought, why isn't this happening to other kids? How is it happening to me, even when people don't know me? Kids, and later adults, were treating me as if they had already met me, and as a result, they treated me with a brisk familiarity. By being Vietnamese, I was tapping into a powerful and activating energy that compelled them to say something to me, to look at me and my family in a way that they didn't look at others. In high school, I first read about the psychoanalyst C.G. Jung and his study of archetypes in his dream analysis. Jung had planted the seeds for groundbreaking ideas that would eventually find their way into psychology, anthropology, and pop culture. But in his pursuit of understanding his patients' dreams, Jung was asking questions that no one dared to answer. Why do so many people have similar recurring motifs in their dreams? And why do so many cultures share similar mythic symbols? Jung shaped what we now know as the archetype and archetypal characters. He proposed that humans all share a collective unconscious, that our shared experiences as homines sapientes laid the bedrock for our dreams and myths. Jung said that we lived in a world of symbolism, internal and external. According to his theories of dream analysis, images and concepts move beneath the surface of our awareness, leviathans of nameless fears and hopes that can evoke a powerful response. Jung writes that a word or an image is symbolic when it implies something more than its obvious and immediate meaning. It has a wider, unconscious aspect that is never precisely defined or fully explained. By those Jungian threads, could people connect us, the trans, to something more than our obvious and immediate meaning? Were there socially constructed images that provoked a stronger response than we could anticipate? Did our symbolism make people call us gooks, tell us to go back to our country, steal our bikes? Had we inadvertently stepped into a national conversation about refugees, patriotism, and the war, unaware of the acrimony and vitriol that preceded us? We had, and we were unconscious of its symbolism. October 1983. Wednesday night, 10 o'clock. Long past our bedtime. Lou and I were jumping up and down on the beds, leaping from one bed to the next. Okay, your turn. A flying leap from my bed to his, a stream of giggles fluttering behind Lou. Okay, now me. I pumped myself up and down a few times before hurling myself across to Lou, arms and legs pulled tight in cannonball position. Great for a pool, not so great for a bed, or your brother on the bed. My full momentum landed on his ankle, and Lou unleashed a howl. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, was immediately met by a barrage of his fists of fury. I deflected a few blows before returning fire. A full-on fistfight raged before my father stormed in. That's it! This is the last time I'm telling you to go to bed! Go to bed, or else! He had already come into our room twice that night after banging on the adjoining wall and yelling at us, go to bed, multiple times. Part of my brain registered the dark circles under his eyes, his disheveled hair, and the sagging lines pulling at his youthful face, which was still boyish at 33. But only part of my brain saw that. The other part of my brain, the reptilian amygdala nut buried deep inside the cortex, thought, he's not going to spank you. What's the or else? What's more fun than jumping? Thanks, amygdala. This is why you're not on top and in charge. But cerebellum was right. The last part of his declaration was toothless. Or else what? It had been 2 years since he had spanked or beaten me. I muttered a dubious, okay. Lights off, again. Within minutes, lights back on. We were engaged in a frantic pillow fight, heaving our pillows. If we were not archetypal boys, what were we? What function did we fulfill, other than brothers who clobbered each other one moment, only to dissolve into tender play the next? I hit Lou with a pillow so hard that he flew off the bed and onto his back, and he burst into laughter. We heard my parents' bedroom door open and close, and we stopped mid-pillow swing. We braced ourselves for more yelling. Maybe we had pushed my father past his breaking point. Maybe this is what it took to provoke Chan Tran into a rage monster. Frozen in battle positions, pillows at the ready, we dropped everything and lunged into the nearest bed together, pulling the covers up over our shoulders, creating an absurd tableau of angelic boys, even if the ruckus belied the mise-en-scene. We waited for our door to open, waited for some yelling. We waited and waited, but nothing happened. We heard talking in the hallway and the jingle of keys. What do you think they're doing? Lou sat up and pushed the covers off. I don't know. Let's go see. I cracked the door open to see my parents, each with a suitcase, coats on and shoes on. Where are you going? I went into the living room, Lou trailing behind me. Are you going somewhere? Lou saw my parents at the top of the stairs. My father looked at us both. We're leaving. You two are so bad, naughty children. We don't know what to do, so we're leaving. Lou immediately began crying. My mother held her eyes fixed to the ground, her green suitcase firmly in her grip. What? I pleaded as Lou's tears triggered my own crying. No, please, we'll be good, please. My father was expressionless, his dark eyes intense and focused. It's too late. We're leaving now. They moved down the stairs. Lou and I grabbed our mother around the waist. My mother, always our solace and comfort, gently nudged us away. For the first time ever, she denied us and my heart rent. We tried a few more times to clasp her waist, rebuffed each time, and my father pulled Lou off. Maybe you'll be good next time. His parting salvo. I sat down, defeated, at the top of the apartment stairs. Please don't leave us. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm so bad. My tears erupting with wails and deep sobbing as I leaned my head against the wall. Lou was racked with grief. I will be good. We will be. I'm so sorry. Please don't leave us. Please. He weakened with crying. We both sat at the top of the stairs as they left, hoping that they would change their minds, but the apartment door closed behind them. We ran to the living room window. From the second floor, we watched the Ford's lights turn on. Were they going to do it? The brake lights flared at the end of the parking lot as the yellow turn signal flickered on the right. Maybe they would stop. The Ford pulled out onto Walnut Bottom Road and drove off. They did it. Lou clung to the windowsill, crying into the pain as I turned around. I didn't think they were going to do it, but they did. I stopped my own tears enough to talk to Lou. Come on, let's sit down. I put my arm around my brother and led him to the velour couch. He sat, tears still falling. What are we going to do? Lou looked at me, and I felt an immediate burden. He needed me to be the big brother. He needed me to know what we were going to do. I choked down a nauseating bolus of abandonment and fear. I can take care of us. I pushed the words out calmly, even though I didn't actually know if I could, but I thought this declaration might comfort Lou. No, you can't. Jesus, really? Have some faith, Lou, I thought. I doubled down. No, I can. Really? No, you can't. You don't have a job. You don't know how to drive. You don't know how to cook. All good points. Well, we walk or ride our bikes everywhere anyway, and Ombawai don't live that far away. They can help us too. Lou started crying harder, which made me start to cry. I'll take care of us, I promise. We're going to starve. No, we won't. We are. We're going to starve. Mom and Dad left us. Jesus Christ, were we already arguing just moments after our parents had packed their bags and left? We were. Will you shut up? We are not going to starve. We aren't. I'll show you. I marched into the kitchen. Sit down. I'll show you. We can do it. Lou sat at the kitchen table, eyes puffy, face wet. From his seat, he glanced out the window behind him, every passing car giving him the false hope that our parents had returned. They hadn't. I grabbed bread and put two slices in the toaster. When they were done, I opened a lower cabinet door and found soy sauce. I sprinkled soy sauce on the toast and clacked the plate in front of Lou. He was incredulous. What's this? Bread with soy sauce? Obviously. See? I told you I could take care of us. Lou cried harder, his face distorting. Stop crying. Just eat it and don't be a baby. I was breaking inside and huffed. Just eat the toast. Eat the toast. I had done my best. I picked up my slice and took a bite. Still warm, crusty, and salty. Lou immediately took the other piece, years of fraternal training and instinct kicking in. He knew that if he didn't claim his toast, I would take it. I watched him force the toast into his mouth, eyeing it with suspicion. His crying stopped as he chewed, slowly and then faster. His countenance unknotted itself as he munched away. This is pretty good. He ate the whole slice. Lou seemed comforted. We wouldn't starve now, provided that we had a steady supply of bread and soy sauce and a toaster. I put the plate into the sink and cleared the table after I got him some water. Our dinner plates that my mother had saved for the morning were heaped up in the sink. I decided I would do the dishes, even though I'd never washed dishes before. Lou watched me as I put on a show, a parody of domestic confidence. Look at me. I can make toast and do the dishes. We'll be fine. I seemed to be saying. In his red and blue Spider-Man pajamas, Lou looked out the window, still monitoring the traffic as I rinsed the dishes. I dried my hands on a towel. Let's go to sleep. I'm tired. Keeping your little brother